model cars expected for big league racing action. The United States versus Canada. 200 laps on the super-fast airborne half mile. The final race to crown the ACT champion. The finish to a sensational year of stock car racing. It all takes place this Saturday afternoon at Airborne Speedway with the Fall Foliage 200 ACT Championship Stock Car Race. Race day includes the Airborne Sportsman Modifieds and Renegades, a great way to end the season. It's the Fall Foliage 200 this Saturday afternoon. Gates open at 10. Post time is 2 o'clock. Admission just $20 for adults, and kids 12 and under are free. Be part of the most powerful sport on earth. ACT presents the Fall Foliage 200. Don't miss it.
It's time to get the story behind the story. Interviews with newsmakers, newsbreakers, and your phone calls. Radio Vermont presents The Mark Johnson Show.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the program. Thanks for tuning in. It's going to be a nicer day out there today a little bit later on, so we'll just leave it at that. A little dark on the way in, but we're getting a little extended summer here. Gotta love that. Coming up on the program this morning, in about 45 minutes here, we'll talk with Jeb Spalding. He is the Secretary of Administration. It was announced yesterday he's going to be taking over the position at the beginning of the year, the Chancellor of the Vermont State Colleges, which is going to be a challenging job because they are really facing some financial uphill battles here. So we'll chat with him about why he's decided to take the job and what he sees as the future for the Vermont State College system. We'll check in with our White House crew to begin hour number two. We'll take your phone calls throughout. Love to hear from you. You can reach us at 244-1777. That's our local number in central Vermont. And you can also reach us on our toll-free lines at 877-291-8255. You're going to want to stick around for our discussion this morning with journalist Paul Barrett. What an incredible story. Paul is the author of Law of the Jungle, the $19 billion legal battle over oil in the rainforest, and the lawyer who stop at nothing to win. And he's kind enough to join us live on the line. Paul, thanks for joining us. How are you this morning?
I'm fine and great to be here. Thanks.
Your background here, you've graduated from Harvard College, Harvard Law School, and you've been an assistant managing editor and senior writer for Bloomberg Businessweek. So clearly you're a well-educated guy who knows what he's talking about here. How did you first get involved in covering this case?
Well, this case, which involves Chevron in the rainforest in Ecuador, has been rolling along since 1993. And I write about legal affairs and big companies and the intersection of society and business. And so I've followed the case for many, many years. I dove in earnest in early 2011 after a New York plaintiff's lawyer named Stephen Donziger won a $19 billion verdict against Chevron in a rainforest courthouse in eastern Ecuador. This was an extraordinary victory, the largest judgment of its kind ever anywhere in the world. And I wanted to know, how had this lawyer, who had pursued this case for the bulk of his career since graduating from Harvard and had never filed another civil lawsuit aside from this one, how did he pull this off? Who was he? And what really happened in Ecuador? So that kind of started my investigation. First, I did a cover story for Business Week magazine, and I was so fascinated, I kept going with the book.
So you were actually more fascinated with Donziger, the lawyer, than with the actual case?
No, I was. I would say initially, I wanted to know who was this guy who had become an environmentalist rock star, and how had he conquered the second biggest oil company in the United States in this faraway courthouse. That was my initial interest, and that was the focus of my magazine article. But then I actually went down to Ecuador and looked around and became fascinated with the underlying situation, which is that there's this industrial zone carved out of the rainforest in Ecuador that's been there since the late 60s and has produced both a great deal of wealth for the country of Ecuador overall, but has left the poor people who live right near the oil operations both poorer in economic terms, and all, literally up to their ankles in waste oil. And I wanted to figure out what had happened there over the decades, and how had it been translated into this this legal battle. And very soon, things it became clear that things were much more complicated than the simple David versus Goliath triumph that the case looks like at first.
Mm-hmm. But the environmental damage, that sounds extensive. Oil up to your ankles? Wow.
Yeah, the environmental damage is extensive. Texaco, which was the original oil company operating in Ecuador in the 70s and the 80s, it did exploration work in the 60s, and they did. Texaco did this, by the way, at the invitation of the Ecuadorian government, under contracts with the Ecuadorian government, and the Ecuadorian government and Ecuadorian companies received the bulk of the proceeds from the oil. So this is not a case, as is often described by critics of the industry, where the oil company snuck in the dark of night and then made off with all the profits. Not at all.
Right.
But in any event, you have this very mixed situation where you have economic benefits but terrible ecological and human costs, and then a lawsuit is filed and there's a demand for someone to be held responsible for this. Is it the oil company? Is it the country of Ecuador? And then how is that lawsuit pursued? Is it done the right way? And those are the questions that I began to investigate.
Right, and we'll get to what some of your findings were. Well, tell me about the Ecuadorian judicial system.
Well, sad to say, the Ecuadorian judicial system is not what it ought to be. What I discovered in looking into this case and what was proved with hard evidence is that, at least at the trial level, judges assume their position in Ecuador all too often simply to sell that position. In this case, in the Ecuadorian phase of this case, which began in 2003 and continues to this day, there were six trial judges who at one time or another presided over the case. Four of them were fired from the bench, were banished from the bench because of corruption of one sort or another. So four out of six, a 666 batting average for corruption, which is, I think, pretty pathetic.
Yeah. Tell me about the lawyer Donziger. What was his background?
Extraordinary guy. He was once a journalist, covered the Nicaraguan Civil War, was very sympathetic at that time to the Sandinistas, the leftist government that was fighting right-wing militias, the Contras, who were supported by the United States. After doing that, he went on to Harvard Law School, where he actually was a friend and basketball buddy of Barack Obama. And after graduating from Harvard Law School, he was introduced by another Harvard Law School classmate to a lawsuit that was just getting going about this pollution in the rainforest. And this was sort of the dream cause, the crusade that he was looking for. He was fluent in Spanish. He knew his way around Latin America already. And he wanted to take up the fight for the poor farmers, the indigenous tribe members, against the big, bad multinational oil company. And in 1993, this lawsuit had a certain amount of merit to it. There was pollution on the ground. It wasn't getting cleaned up, but then things very quickly got much more complicated.
Mm-hmm. Did you overlap with him at Harvard Law?
I did not. We are the same age, but I went straight to law school from college, and he went off on these interesting adventures, first in Central America and in Nicaragua, as I mentioned, and also spent a year as a prisoner advocate on behalf of Cuban prisoners who were incarcerated in southeastern United States in the wake of the Mariel boat lift. So he had done these other quite fascinating undertakings before he circled back to Harvard Law School.
We're talking with Paul Barrett. He's the author of Law of the Jungle, the $19 billion legal battle over oil in the rainforest, and lawyer who'd stop at nothing to win. So what did you and this Manhattan federal judge conclude that the verdict was based on? What?
Yeah. Well, so Donziger wins this huge victory. Chevron is thumped in the courtrooms of Ecuador. But meanwhile, Chevron says, A, we're not going to pay a dime. We've been cheated here. B, we have no assets in Ecuador. So there's actually nothing for Donziger and his clients to seize and sell off. Chevron comes back to New York, sues Donziger and his clients under the U.S. anti-racketeering law. And this past March, a federal judge in New York rules that what may have once been a legitimate lawsuit evolved over time into a corporate shakedown, literally an extortion racket that involved fabricated evidence, coercion of judges, forging of scientific reports, and even the ghostwriting of the ultimate $19 billion judgment in exchange for a promise to pay the judge who put his name on it $500,000. And so that's where that case stands now. The U.S. judiciary has said this guy doesn't have a legitimate victory over Chevron. Even though there is pollution, this guy tried to deal with it in a way that was underhanded and illegal, and he may not profit from that ill-gotten verdict.
So is Donziger in criminal legal trouble?
Not yet. And at the moment, he has not even been accused of criminal charges. However, the judge in this civil lawsuit filed by Chevron did find that he violated laws, like the racketeering laws, that have criminal provisions. He did find that he obstructed justice. He did find that he coerced judges. Those infractions, which the judge has already found in a civil context, can certainly be translated into a criminal context if a criminal prosecutor were to take up the baton and move forward. But first, Donziger is appealing. This case is going to go to the Federal Court of Appeals here in New York, and Chevron is, of course, answering and saying, no, we want to see this verdict left in place. And Chevron is so intent on doing that because Donziger has not given up. He is active in yet other countries, Canada, Argentina, Brazil, where he is taking this Ecuadorian verdict and saying to the judiciaries of these other countries, you enforce this. Chevron does have assets in your country. I want you, Canadian judge, recognize my Ecuadorian verdict and allow me to go to a Chevron refinery and literally sell it off so I can get billions of dollars. So Chevron is fighting those efforts, and its main weapon is the ruling from New York that says Donziger is not a legitimate lawyer. He's a racketeer.
And did you find the same thing?
Yes. In a word, my findings were entirely parallel with those of U.S. District Judge Lewis Kaplan. I think there is overwhelming evidence that Donziger not just cut the corners, but behaved unlawfully in the courts in Ecuador. And his own statements, his own email, his own writings, his diaries show that. And all of this extraordinary information came to the surface in the course of Chevron's racketeering suit against him. In the so-called discovery process, Chevron was able to get a hold of an extraordinary amount of information, much of it in Donziger's own voice and in his own hand. And some of that information, fascinatingly, came from the field tapes from a documentary film that he had procured. He persuaded a prominent documentary filmmaker named Joe Berlinger to make a film called Crude that celebrated his lawsuit. The film was critically acclaimed, debuted in 2009 in Sundance, but Chevron used the film as a basis for getting at his information. The oil company said to the judge in New York, we think that the outtakes from this film, the stuff left on the cutting room floor, will show that Donziger is a corrupt guy, and the judge, on that suspicion, told the filmmaker, you have to turn over 600 hours of field tape. And on that field tape, sure enough, were statements by Donziger about how the Ecuadorian judiciary is corrupt. That was him talking. How he was going to manipulate the Ecuadorian judiciary, how the judges were afraid of him, and that the only thing that was important was power and pressure. And these statements ended up being very incriminating and informing the federal court ruling against him, but also informing my view and my assessment of what transpired.
We're talking with Paul Barrett, the author of Law of the Jungle, because you did write this piece about him for Business Week, and back in 2011, Fortune magazine said it was very sympathetic. So did you change your view on this guy?
My view definitely evolved. My colleague, Roger Parloff at Fortune, has chided me slightly, although he's been very kind in praising my book overall. He's chided me slightly because he thinks I've been too fair, as he puts it, to Stephen Donziger, and too harsh on Chevron. Now look, reasonable people can disagree on the margins here. My original article, I would say, was not overwhelmingly popular, favorable to Donziger. It raised questions. It was based on a few weeks' worth of reporting. The headline was something along the lines of corporate gadfly, rainforest crusader, or fraud, question mark. So the questions were raised initially, but it is true that over time, that question mark evolved into a period. Over time, I had the opportunity to examine the evidence in far greater depth, and frankly, a lot more evidence came to the surface. And in my dealings with Donziger initially, he misled me. I asked him questions about what his methods had been. He denied certain allegations that Chevron was making about the ghostwriting of supposedly neutral scientific reports and the like, and he just flat out denied it and looked me in the eye and said it hadn't happened. And then it turned out that he later just admitted that it had happened. So, you know, you're a journalist, you keep going. Like a police investigator, you start in one place and you end up wherever the facts take you.
You know, I mean, one of the real shames of this is that, what about the people of Ecuador? What about these people living in ankle-deep oil? They're getting kind of the shaft on this, huh?
You've now put your finger on the most important point. Because while the story of Donziger is a fascinating tale of just a totally compelling anti-hero, the upshot of all this, the important thing, is that the cause he purported to be pressing, the vindication of the poor and the oppressed in Ecuador, that has been undermined by his actions. So you're exactly right. 21 years of litigation, beginning in the United States, moving down to Ecuador, and now spread out all over the world, as I mentioned, 21 years of litigation has not done one good thing for his client. It hasn't cleaned up a barrel of spilled oil. It hasn't purified a contaminated stream. It hasn't built a medical clinic. And by the way, that's not only because of Donziger's missteps, but also because of the government of Ecuador, which I would argue has a great deal of culpability here as well, because the national oil company that replaced Texaco became every bit as bad a polluter in the 90s and the 2000s. Mm-hmm. And the government of Ecuador has not done its part either, and the poor people suffer.
Now, there was some settlement with the Ecuadorian government. How much was that, and did it get to any people?
Well, there wasn't really a settlement. I mean, Texaco did make certain payments on its way out of the country. It spent some $40 million to clean up a portion of the pollution sites under a contract it had with the government of Ecuador, whereby the government of Ecuador promised to clean up two-thirds of the sites, while Texaco would clean up one-third of the sites. Why that division? Because that reflected the ownership interests in the former joint consortium that operated all these sites. Texaco owned one-third, the government of Ecuador owned two-thirds. The government of Ecuador never fulfilled its promises and has really let its own people down. So there was that agreement, and under that agreement, Texaco was actually given a legal release from further responsibility by the government of Ecuador. But that settlement, I think the better term for it is probably a release agreement, didn't really directly benefit the individual people to any significant degree.
Mm-hmm. You know, I'm thinking of the BP spill. Has there ever been a judgment and maybe Alaska too, $19 billion? I mean, that's a huge settlement.
That's a huge amount. There has never, in a single lawsuit against a single allegedly misbehaving corporation, there has never been a judgment of that significance. Now, I don't want to mislead people. The spill in the Gulf of Mexico was a far bigger event. And BP, by the way, has already paid out some $28 billion in cleanup costs and claims in the Gulf, and BP is going to be paying out more. So my point here is, but the interesting thing is, BP is actually cleaning things up, and something was done to remediate the terrible damage that was done in the Gulf. As a result of the bizarre nature of the case in Ecuador, very little to nothing is being done to clean up. That's the huge contrast. And the contamination has continued. It's continuing in real time. When I was down there doing my reporting, I saw with my own eyes an oil spill unfolding that was being the fault of Petroecuador, the national oil company that now operates the oil fields. So this is a continuing ecological disaster unfolding even as we speak, without the remediation that's necessary.
What do you think is going to happen to Donziger here?
Yeah, I don't know. He's appealing this RICO finding, and we'll have to see what the federal appeals court says. It's very unusual for a federal appeals court to second-guess the factual findings of a trial judge that have been entered in this case. The trial judge here, Judge Lewis Kaplan, issued a ruling some 485 pages long, 1,872 footnotes. Yes, I counted. Mm-hmm. And it's very federal appeals courts normally leave the fact-finding to the judge who ran the trial, and this judge ran a six-week trial in late 2013. But having said that, there are significant legal questions as to how this thing gets resolved. The judge, Judge Kaplan issued what's called an injunction, an order, that said that Donziger and his clients may not benefit from the fraudulent verdict in Ecuador. It's possible that the Federal Appeals Court will actually say, you know, a U.S. judge can't go that far. It can't bar the victims from getting some compensation if another country's judiciary says they deserve it. It may split the difference. It may say Donziger cannot benefit from anything that he did because he was the one responsible for misconduct. He can't get any of the money, but something must be done for the innocent victims. So we'll see how the Federal Appeals Court deals with this. It's a quite a complicated situation. And another fascinating fact is that the Ecuadorians, the victims, now have their own separate lawyer, a very eminent human rights lawyer who's a professor at NYU named Bert Newborn, has parachuted into the case. And in this appeal, he is the one representing the individual Ecuadorians. Donziger has his own lawyer, and to some degree there is now tension between the two, because Newborn is saying Donziger may have committed misconduct. That's not my concern. My concern is only that his clients not be punished for any misconduct he did. So Newborn is actually presenting the appeals court, in my view, with a potential middle path, a way to say that this kind of legal misbehavior cannot be tolerated, but on the other hand, there are innocent people here and something must be done for them.
So is that through the original case, or are they going through this civil case now?
What I've just been describing is through the racketeering case that Chevron brought. The original case is still, is an Ecuadorian judgment that, as far as the sovereign state of Ecuador is concerned, is a legitimate judgment. The problem is it has no practical effect in Ecuador because Chevron has no assets there.
But that's interesting because what I'm hearing you say is that Chevron may have be playing a bit of a gamble here. By filing this suit, they open themselves up to having this judgment get attached to that case.
It is possible. Chevron does have risks, and Chevron is not out of the woods yet. As far as the international legal system is concerned, the sovereign state of Ecuador, all the way up to the Ecuadorian Supreme Court, has upheld Chevron's liability, so that if the sovereign state of Argentina were to say, we respect Ecuador, we don't respect the United States, Argentina could say to Donziger, you may now go and sell off that ship that Chevron owns, that refinery, that pipeline. That is theoretically possible. Chevron says, no way. Hell will freeze over before we pay a dime, and we will fight this thing forever. And our main weapon is Judge Kaplan's ruling that Donziger is basically a racketeer.
So there's not some sort of agreement the way there is, like with extradition between countries, of honoring settlements?
No, there actually, it's not a question of an agreement via treaty the way it exists for extradition. But there is international common law, judge-made law, pronouncements from the bench, whereby countries ordinarily do respect each other's judgments, very much so. And that's what Donziger is saying to the judges in Argentina, Brazil, and Canada. According to international law, he's saying, you must respect the Ecuadorian judiciary. That's a upstanding country, member of the United Nations, etc. Mm-hmm. But there's an exception to that generalization. The exception is that the judgment in question is based on fraud, and Chevron is putting all its chips on that exception.
Wow. There's a lot of money riding on this.
Absolutely.
Now, Donziger's going after you now, saying that you're part of the problem. What's the claim he's making, and what do you say to him?
Yeah, Donziger goes after everyone who he considers to be getting in his way. He has had fallings out with almost all of his former co-counsel. Almost all of his former scientific advisors have disavowed their work for him and accused him of deceit. Even his former financiers have accused him of fraud. Now, I write a book that lays the story out, and by the way, lays the story out in a way that some of my rivals in the media say is too sympathetic to him, and yet he smears me too. This is his M.O., he is an attack artist. He is a practitioner of, sort of what the Clintons used to call the politics of destruction. And this is how he rolls. His MO is simply to slash and burn and attack personally anyone who basically tries to say what's really going on. I am not an opponent of his. I am a teller of the story. If you read Joe Nocera in the New York Times, just this past Tuesday, Joe devoted a column to my book and to this whole story, in which he said he found my version of events credible and Donziger's not credible. If you read Roger Parloff in Fortune magazine, he has said exactly the same thing. Mm-hmm. And now for their troubles, Donziger is smearing both Joe Nocera and Roger Parloff, accusing them of conflicts of interest and so forth. In a word, it's baloney.
Well, you're in good company.
That's right.
Let me take one call, let you go. We go to Montpelier. Mark, I got to be quick here. Good morning.
Oh, hi. Good morning. Thanks for the show. If you were a fly on the wall among oil executives, and the discussion over dinner was 50, 100 years ahead, what's their discussion?
In terms of what?
In terms of how to generate energy on the earth.
Okay. What do you think, Paul?
100 years from now, if we're genuinely talking about 100 years from now, we're going to be out of most oil, and if we haven't managed to innovate and find other sources of energy, we're going to be in very bad shape. But I personally have faith in scientific ingenuity that we're going to be deriving energy from sources that we today literally can't even imagine.
Why does this story even matter?
This story matters because the rule of law matters, because people, individuals, activists, lawyers who want to use the legal system to hold large corporations accountable for their alleged misconduct frequently want to do this with the rule of law, through the courts. They want to enjoy the leveling ethos of the courtroom, where even an individual, a sole person, or a group of poor people can come in and, with a good lawyer, take on a multi-billion dollar corporation or take on a government agency and say to the judge, "Judge, you have to do justice here, even though we are much weaker out on the street than this huge opponent of ours." But if the rule of law gets corrupted, if the rule of law is made into a sham, as happened in this case, according to Judge Lewis Kaplan, then that tool deteriorates, it erodes, it falls away, and other people who want to use it will not have access to it. The U.S. courts are already limiting the degree to which lawyers can use mass litigation to accomplish social goals. They are limiting the degree to which you can bring a lawsuit in this country for alleged misconduct overseas. And this case will accelerate that process, I fear, because of the hypocrisy that was undertaken.
You know, and the unknown question seems to really be, would there have been a judgment without the bad stuff, the tampering, and the everything else?
There very may well have been. It's a complicated question. Remember that Texaco had those contractual and legal defenses, that it had its deals with the government of Ecuador, but maybe those deals were open to question. The sad thing is that the fraud and the misconduct have now so clouded the situation that we may never know. The sad thing is that with all of this legal maneuvering, the vital underlying scientific work that was necessary wasn't done on the ground in Ecuador, and so now the whole thing is very cloudy. And we need an outside intervention. We need, in the wake of all this litigation, some foundation, some eminent international body to come in and say, look, we want to actually get something done here. We have to set aside the litigation, round up some money,
yep,
get some oil pits cleaned up, and get the lawyers off to the margins.
Ankle deep in oil will be the phrase I will remember from this interview for many years to come.
I appreciate your time.
Thank you for yours. Paul Barrett is the author of Law of the Jungle, the $19 billion legal battle over oil in the rainforest. This was done in Ecuador, and the lawyer who'd stop at nothing to win. Wow. You want to talk about a multi-layered story. Holy cow. All right, coming up in about 10 minutes here, we'll be chatting with the Secretary of Administration. Jeb Spaulding will join us this morning. Yesterday, what a rapid change of events here. The trustees at the Vermont State College System out on a retreat and had been having discussions with the Secretary of Administration and deciding that they would offer him the job yesterday. He accepted it, and they immediately got a press release out. Now, not everybody's totally happy with the decision-making process. Members of the staff and faculty felt as though they were going to be consulted on this and really feel as though they were not. It's not a complete smooth sailing on this. But we'll talk about that. Anything else you want to chat about this morning on the program, you're welcome to join us. 244-1777. That's our local number in central Vermont. You can also reach us on our toll-free lines at 877-291-8255. Coming up tomorrow on the program, we'll talk with environmentalist Bill McKibben. He's been down in New York following the events of the climate change. There was a march, and also there's been a conference going on. Also, we'll talk with him. Interesting piece yesterday in 7 Days, Paul Heintz writing about Governor Shumlin and his changing views on divestiture and not investing in oil companies. A nugget of news that came out of David Goodman's program right here on this radio station on WDEV, his program, the Vermont Conversation, where the governor, who had really not been all that high on this idea, now saying that he thinks it's a good idea, won't happen immediately. And as Bill McKibben notes in Paul's piece, you know, if the Rockefeller family is looking at divesting its philanthropic portfolios from oil and fossil fuel, you know, I mean, that's where the fortune came from. It's like an $850 million endowment that they're talking about, too. As Bill McKibben says, you know, what's the argument that other people have? Not a bad line. So we'll talk with him on the program tomorrow. 244-1777, that's our local number in central Vermont. You can also reach us toll-free at 877-291-8255. We'll be back right after this.
We are high performance.